Am I Paul alcoholic?
No.
You know, thank Larry for asking me to talk. I've been traveling the last year and 4 months or so. I've just been traveling and kind of out of my element. I got sober at Pathfinders, and so it's kind of like I don't know. Many of you guys might know, but I'm kind of a big book guy, And so sometimes when I go to other places that I'm not familiar with, I go to different meetings and I don't speak their language. I truly don't speak their language. I mean, I know that they're alcoholic because of some of the stories they tell, but the solution that they bring and that they describe, it just boggles my mind. You know, and then I see some of them, you know, this is just an observation, and, you know, some that are like 5 years sober, just miserable. Just totally miserable, unhappy, right? And still complaining about the little chicken stuff, you know, that they did, you know, within 90 days sober. And I look at this case, and I look at Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, and I think that there's something askew, because there is a way out. You know, there truly is a way out. You know, this is not just about not drinking, but that's way up there. You know, sobriety's way up there. Right? This is about a way of living. You know, it's about how do I feel comfortable in my own skin, right? How do I stop hurting people around me? How do I stop being so selfish? You know, this is about going on vacation. This is about enjoying life. This is about art. You know, this is about theater. This is about doing all those things that I just talked about and dreamt about sitting on that bar stool. Right? That's what this is about. Right? This is not about me being afraid for people, places, and things. You know, and this, this is my story. You know, this is just my perception, you know, and, you know, that's it. Is that if I believe that I have a trigger, that I put conditions on my sobriety. You know, if I truly think that I have a trigger, that I can't go around people, places, or things, then I have a condition on my sobriety. And when I got sober, I didn't want any part of that. You know, I wanted to be free, and I was willing to do whatever it took for as long as it took in order for me to stop feeling this way and hurting the people around me and get free. You know, this is my first time ever getting sober. You know, and I've been sober since January 17th, 1994. You know, and, it used to say, anybody here remember the Northridge earthquake? Right, that's my sobriety date. Right, I'm serious. You know, I'm sitting in this truck. Well, I'll tell you the ending here, you know, before I get into the beginning. But I'm sitting in this truck in Balboa Park, hitting this crack pipe, right? And you know, and I'm not much on crack. You know, that's like first or second time I ever did it. But man, did I love it. You know, and all of a sudden my truck started to shake. And I go, holy crap! You know, this is some good stuff here. You know. Not to say I'm important or anything, you know, but there, you know, there was a plan here. There truly was a plan, you know, and how all that, you see, that's just the ending of all this. That's the ending of what it was like. The beginning of what it was like was a kid of six, you know, I had five other siblings and an alcoholic father. And, you know, I'm the only drunk of the bunch, you know, and my father was an alcoholic, and my first drink was when I was a kid. I don't remember how old, but I just remembered this because it hurt. And he gave me this jalapeno pepper, you know, and he was just kind of like playing. He just wanted to see what it do to the little boy. You know? And then he gave me a beer to quench it down, you know, and so I kind of related to that, to drinking, you know. And so my first drunk was you know, you hear that if you were to stick a straw in a can of beer and drink it, you get drunk? Right? Well, I did that, but this can of beer that we stole was a Slitz Colt 45 malt liquor. And I got wasted and just wound up just, you know, I thought it was funny at the time. You know, I got so drunk that I'm kind of spinning around this backyard and just plowed right into a tree and down I went. And what I realized in hindsight was I was going to do that a lot. I was going to do that a lot. I did it with cars, right? I did it with relationships. I did it with jobs, right? Just around in circles and then smack into the wall and fall down and get back up over and over again, you know? And so after that, you know, it's kind of like, you just kind of progressed. Yeah, I like to look, you know, the book talks about the three types of drinkers, right? There's a moderate drinker and a hard drinker and the real alcoholic, right? And so I put it like this. I was a moderate drinker in like elementary and middle school. You know, I could take it or leave it alone. You know, I could seriously take it or leave it alone. Right? You know, up until like the 7th, 8th grade. Well, in the 9th grade, between the 8th and 9th grade year, I kind of crossed the line to become from a moderate drinker to a hard drinker, I think. Right? And I kept searching for something more, you know, a little bit stronger. You know, and my very first wrestling match with anything was with peppermint schnapps. Yeah? And it was a cold morning. I was in, I lived in Greenville, South Carolina. And it was a cold morning. I was sitting down on the curb waiting for my friend's brother to come pick us up in his nice new shiny car. Right? And this thing had leather interior. And I'm sitting outside. And I don't know if you guys ever, you know, realize this, but as you're drinking outside in the cold, it doesn't quite hit you till you warm up. Right? And when it hit me, when I warmed up, it wasn't pretty. You know? And so this guy's car, it was a mess. You know? And but I knew that I'd try this again. You know, because I got this effect. Right? I got this effect. And you know, early on in my childhood, I stuttered a lot. I didn't quite feel like I felt, you know, I fit in. There was, we were, my mom and dad had divorced when I was very young, like 6 or 8. So there were 6 of us, and my mom was raising 6 of us in the early 70s with no welfare, just poverty. You know, and the only thing to eat is you open it up and you get a stale piece of toast or a stale piece of bread and you put it in the toaster and you toast it, you know, kind of fooling yourself, you know? You know, so it was that kind of life. And so it was kind of working, you know, working hand to mouth, basically, was what it was. And so I would look at other people in school and in churches and knew that I absolutely was not like you. And then you told me I wasn't like you. Right? You know, I wanted to join the Cub Scouts in the Southern Baptist Church, but because I couldn't afford it, I couldn't join. You know, so over and over again, and I don't want any self-pity of this crap. You know, I mean, it happened. You know, but over and over again, you know, humanity, society told me that I just wasn't the one. You know, and that's how I felt on the inside, too. It was like there's something missing. I'm just not enough. You know, and then I discovered, alcohol kind of changed that. And it didn't quite take it away, but it meant it was tolerable. There's a part in the book, right, on page 52, where it says, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We're having troubled personal relationships. We can't control our emotional nature. We're a prey to misery and depression. We can't make a living. We have a feeling of uselessness. We're full of fear. We're unhappy. And we can't seem to be a real help to other people. Now, if I were to take that, which is in the book, right, it's called The Bedevilments, you know, if I were to take that and apply those questions to how I felt when alcohol worked, when alcohol did what it was supposed to do, right? I was not having troubled personal relationships, right? When alcohol worked, I was not full of fear. When alcohol worked, I could control my emotional nature, right? I could make a difference. I had a feeling that I could do anything when alcohol worked. But at some point in this progression, it stopped working. And it's not like it's all of a sudden just one time, you know, a light switch goes off and it just stops working. Right, it's this thing, it's this progressiveness of this thing, and more about alcoholism. It says that we switch from this to this. Well, as I started going from the peppermint schnapps, I left that alone because the peppermint schnapps is kicking my butt, right? And then I went into Bacardi 151, right? And that stuff really kicked my butt, you know. So I kept leaving aside all these things because they're the problem, you know. I couldn't put it together. And so there was a bout with box wine. Anybody ever drink box wine? Right? How about, Boone's Farm or Mad Dog or, right? Or Ripple Shit, you know? Right? I know back then if it had a screw cap, it wasn't natural. It just wasn't natural. Right? And so in the book, when it says only drinking natural wines, I knew what they were talking about. Right? I could totally relate to that. You know, because there was no grapes in that stuff. Absolutely no grapes whatsoever. And so, and so when I started reading this stuff, I started thinking back in hindsight because I was taught and told early on that the first step is intended to already have been worked once you got here. The first step is in reflection of what's already happened in past tense. My drinking career. I had this delusion about tomorrow, You know, that if I find the right balance and the right girl and, you know, the right picket fence and all this other crap, my life is going to be good. Right? So I got this delusion about tomorrow, but the facts of yesterday are bad. You know, they are bad. You know, but I didn't believe that as this was going on. Right? I kept switching from this to this, you know. And there was one case, I think it was like in the eighth grade. Right? It's, you know, I was willing to try anything to fit in. You know, I was willing to try anything to fit in with a cool guy down the street. And he wanted to go get these drugs, and they called it crystal tea. I have no idea what it was, even to this day. Right? So we went to this dark alley, knocked on this door. This guy gave us this little white bag of powder. Right? And off we went, and then we went back to his apartment. It's like midnight by now. You know? And, you know, and I'm in eighth grade. And so this guy opens it up, he sticks a little tip of a knife blade in it, and just snorts a little bit and sets it down. And then I do the same thing, but I didn't get any effect. Right? Because now, you know, what I know now is I need instant gratification. Right? I need to feel that wow. Right? And what I didn't get it when I did that. So there was a pen sitting next to it, and I cracked open the pen, shoved it down there, snorted the whole thing up, and... And the next thing I know, I'm waking up in the hospital 3 days later, and everything looks like it's going in slow motion. And I have these tubes coming out of me that ought not be coming out of an eighth grader. And, you know, and I'm thinking it's a dream. You know, starting out until the dream didn't end. You know, because my mother should not have been crying over me in the dream. And, wow, what an awakening that was. And so what my mother did was shortly after that, this was in Greenville, South Carolina. And so what my mother did shortly after that was she happened, just by chance, there was one of her old boyfriends came down from Indiana and swooped her up and married her. And she thought it'd be a good idea if she got me out of, you know, away from people, places, and things. You know, and so they moved me up to this little farming community up in northeastern Indiana. Right? No paved streets, nothing like that. Just cornfields, a couple factories, and a lot of bars. Right? And that's where I grew up from the age of like 15 or 14 up to like 23 before I joined the Navy. And so what do you suppose happened when my mother took me away from those people, places, and things? Those things were... See, I have this illness, and this is what I've discovered since I've been sober, is the illness I have is not external. The illness I have has nothing to do with you, right? It has nothing to do with where I am, right? The illness that I have is internal. You take me away from people, places, and things, and I'll just find different people in different places and maybe try different things, you know, but the result is still the same. Jails, yeah, I started going to jail. I managed to stay away from institutions for a while, but hospitals, I was in a hospital. You know, because of that OD. You know, so over and over again, this thing is just starting to progress. And back in the early 70s, middle 70s, when the cops would pull you over for drinking, right, especially a young kid like me, a jock, you know, at the time, you know, an athlete because they didn't want me to get in trouble, they would just take my keys and make me sleep it off. I don't know how many times that happened. You know, my 21st birthday, I woke up in a cornfield, right? And they're right in the middle of a cornfield, you know, and I don't know if you've ever been in a cornfield when they're, you know, pretty tall and you had no idea which way to go, you know, over and over and over again. And so, my first DUI was in Michigan. Then I got another one in Indiana, and the third DUI in Indiana, I decided that it's time to get the heck out of town, right? Leave, you know? And you know, I'd like to say that I joined the Navy out of virtue to go serve my country and do the right thing. That is not the truth. I joined the Navy to get the heck out of that town, you know, because I'm going to jail. You know, I just can't stay out of trouble here. And in my mind, you know, I have this picture. I'm a visual person. That's how I live most of the time, is just by visual. I see things in my mind of how things are supposed to be, and then I make them so or try to make them so. You know? And so I have this picture in my mind of what a sailor's like. He drinks a lot and plays chess. Right? And stuck out in the middle of the water, nobody bothers them. So I figured that's for me. So I joined the Navy, you know. And the very first thing in the Navy was they gave me this little test, you know. And, and there was a list coming out around a boot camp. And you know you were on that list because you failed this test, right, for pot, marijuana, right? And so anyway, you know, they allowed me to stay in the Navy because I had told them, you know, a little bit before I got in, a little bit disclosure, right? So at that time, they allowed me to stay in. Anyway, my first escapade in the Navy was, I think I had been in a couple years, right? And I have this visual thing of what sailors and Marines are supposed to do, right? So I'm in this bar in Imperial Beach, you know, drinking. I think it's called I forget the name of it. It's a Western bar, you know, and I'm not a Western kind of guy, but, you know, I just happen to be down there. And and so I get this picture, and this little Marine kind of, he just, you know, he looked at me funny. You know, I don't know, you guys can relate to that. Somebody looks at you, you go, yeah, I know what you're thinking. I got you. Right? And so for no reason, I smacked him upside the head with a beer bottle. You know, start a barroom brawl. Right? Because that's what sailors and Marines are supposed to do. You know, so over and over again, I would start, you know, I would just fight. You know, for no reason at all. And the one time I got caught, I'm standing in front of a judge and the district attorney and, you know, and this public defender, and everybody's sitting there trying to, you know, look through their paperwork going, well, Your Honor, you know, the judge is asking, why did he hit him? And they're trying to find an excuse. You know, they're trying to find a reason in this paperwork, and there's not one. You know, so... You know, so things are just getting progressively worse, you know, over and over again. I got this letter on my very first Westpac. I got this. We were just heading out, and I got this letter from the American Red Cross that said my biological father had just died, right? And I didn't know the guy. I mean, I didn't know him. You know, he was gone. And so first, you know, I wadded the piece of paper up and threw it in the trash, and then this thought occurred to me. I get emergency leave. And so I pulled this piece of paper out of the trash, you know, pulled it up, you know, kind of forced some tears out a little bit, went up to the chief engineer, and the next thing I know, I'm being catapulted off the Kitty Hawk. Right? And, you know, it's like, gone, you know? And so I spent the next month just partying, right? From Guam, Diego Garcia, San Diego, Hawaii. I never did go back to, you know, with the family to bury him, do the funeral. You know, I never did do that. But the epilogue of this particular thing was that they finally got enough of me, you know, ducking and dodging. You know, I was in this place and my only job was to answer the phones for 4 hours a night, and I couldn't make it, you know. And I couldn't make it, so they said, that's it. So they, you know, so they wanted me, you know, they were sending me back aboard the ship. Well, these orders that I had said fly to Manila. And that's, you know, that's what they said. So, you know, a ship's in Longapo, the Philippines, which is, I don't know, 100 miles south there. I know, it's in the same freaking place. You know, pretty close, right? And so as I flew into Manila, and as I'm riding this little jeepney down and just starting to party, the thought occurs to me that my order said fly to Manila. It didn't tell me what to do after that. So, I mean, I got this mind to just kind of rationalize itself back into the, either keep the party going or the next drink, you know, regardless of the consequences, regardless of what I promised the boss, regardless of what I promised, you know, promised her, regardless of the necessity or the wish. I have a mind that will rationalize itself into the next drink regardless, and that's what it did. And I'm sitting there riding this jeepney and said, okay, so I just stopped and partied for 3 days, and then I, you know, by the time I went back to the pier, there's not a boat there. right, the boat's gone. And so they, you know, they obviously, they arrested me, put me on this jet, and I'm hungover. I'm bad. Right, and it was a lot funner being catapulted off that thing sober than it was landing on it hungover. And the first thing they did is they come and they got me, they threw me in the brig, and they were gonna, you know, send me up to this mast, And this little cocky little E3 guy that I'm at, and I'm sitting there pointing at the orders, you know, like pounding my spoon, you know, going, it said fly to Manila, and I flew to Manila. It didn't tell me what to do after that. They couldn't do anything about it. Because I don't know if you guys are familiar with the military, but they're pretty, you know, it's straight to the letter. You know, and so I got away with that. Over and over again, there were just things, just, you know, I remember one story in the Navy where this guy pissed me off. I had this bike, you know, because I got a DUI and a bicycle on the base. Yeah, it's possible. I got a DUI and a bicycle, right? A total of six of them all together. Yeah, and I'm still driving. Anyway, this guy just pissed me off. He trashed my bike. Right? And so I'm just really arrogant, cocky guy, and I'm figuring that as long as I'm dressed a certain way, nobody's going to question me. So aboard this ship, I strung welding leads across the deck, right? This was in the middle of the night, and strung these welding leads across the deck, put the bicycle up on the bulkhead and welded it to the, you know, and said, you want this thing, you got it. You know? Over and over and over again, it's the same story. You know, drunken, and then from the Navy, I barely squeaked out of the Navy. Barely squeaked out of the Navy. They never even asked me to reenlist because it was, you know. There's a lot of stories I can't tell because there's women here, but, you know, and I wouldn't anyway. But out of the Navy, I took this job in this pizza place. And what you're going to hear here, at least in my story, is that I supported my alcoholism with stealing. Stealing, plain and simple, right? I'm a thief, right? I supported my alcoholism by taking things that belong maybe to you. I don't know. And so I started out with this pizza place. Godfather's Pizza used to be here in town. And so I had the key to their, you know, to their stores, and I'd go in at night, and that's where I had the, you know, the wrestling match with the box wine. Yeah. I'd go in and I'd help myself to their, you know, to the food, take it home, I'd help myself to the beer, you know. And then I, you know, started doing this restaurant maintenance. You know, I was doing restaurant maintenance for Bennigan's. Right? And so it worked out really well until one morning where I had the completely restaurant tore apart. And I had discovered that although the taps were turned off, you could still get beer out, right? And so I spent the whole night drinking. And when they finally got in the morning, I was passed out in the booth, you know. So over and over again, you know. You know, and then I worked at this university here in town. They used to call it USIU. Right? At this time, I was going to school. I was furthering my education. Right, I was in refrigeration school at the time. And then, you know, so as my education started to progress, so did the alcoholism, right? So did the drinking. So did the trouble, right? So did the escapades. You know, so I'm working at this place called USIU, and I had just put in my 2 weeks' notice because I'm finally going to graduate from this air conditioning school, and I can go get a real job. You know, I can go get the job that I want to get, the air conditioning job. And so I put my 2 weeks' notice into this place, and it was a nice warm spring day, you know, and I went up on the cafeteria and cut their heating system out of nothing but copper. You know, threw it in the back of my truck and off I went. Right? They didn't need it, you know, but I needed some drinking money. And what I discovered is copper is a great source of instant money. Right? So copper is a great source of instant, you know, but I didn't have the brains the next day to wear different shoes. So I'm back up on the roof with this boss who discovered that the heating system's gone, and you know I'm the likely culprit. But me, I won't confess even if you have all the proof whatsoever. I will deny it even if you have pictures. I'm going to deny it, you know. And so yeah, over and over again, just you know, I'd already given my 2 weeks' notice at that job, so you know, so they weren't really you know there. You know, anyway, I was gone. And the next job, you know, like this refrigeration company, you know, I'd get thirsty. In the afternoon, I'd get thirsty, so I'd just pull into a parts house and get a length of copper, cut it up, and go to the scrap house. You know, and need a drink. And, you know, And the simplest way of doing this was I had a tool bucket that had a false bottom. Right? And so we had the account at several mobile gas stations. And so all I needed to do, because I had the shirt and the badge and all this stuff in the truck, was just walk right into a mobile station, into their cooler, and put a six-pack in, act like I'm checking something, and then out the door I went. So I supported my alcoholism by theft. You know, and all this progressed, and the very last job that I had was in an apartment complex, because by this time, I couldn't buy a job. There was no references. You know, absolutely, I couldn't even put down any work history. I was afraid they're going to call. I'm just a thief, you know. And this very last place I worked, I'm spinning hard. I'm crashing hard. Crystal meth is kicking my ass. The vodka, the beer's kicking my ass. I'm just spiraling, you know. And it's around Christmas time in 1993. And this last job I had keys to these apartments. And so I started stealing from apartments. Started stealing checks. Getting a copy of your signature. Going to the bank and writing myself a check. And there was a bank that I walked into, and I knew that they would call and verify. I knew it going in. I knew it from doing legitimate business. You know, in hindsight, I called the cops on myself. I didn't know how to stop this spiral. You know, the house was going in foreclosure. The wife was gone. I had already given up the two kids. You know, all this stuff was gone. You know, and I didn't know how to stop it. You know, so in hindsight, I called the cops on myself. So I walked in this place, tried to cash this forged check that I had stolen from a tenant where I worked, and they wouldn't cash it. And the next morning, I went into work early in the morning, and the owner was there, and the bosses were there, and they gave me my last check and said, you know, the sheriff's department's coming to get you. And so I took off. Took that last check, went to the home, back to the home I was losing, to the wife that I was losing, you know, and said, I got to go. You know, make arrangements for me to go to treatment tomorrow. Because in my mind, the only way I'm going to get out of this, I need a place to breathe and calm down. I have no intentions of getting sober, but I need a place to calm down, you know, and kind of think about how I'm going to get out of this one. All right? And so that entire day before I could get in there, I did nothing but just party. On the streets of San Diego, party, everything. And the next morning, is when the Northridge earthquake hit. And I'm sitting in that truck, and then I'm going to this treatment center. And they want me to do outpatient, and I'm going, no, you can't do that. I need to be in, you know, because the cops are out there. Anyway, what happened in this treatment center was two very important things that changed my life. The first very important thing was they introduced me to this theory that my body may not metabolize alcohol properly. Right? That was the first theory, you know. And then they would bust me around to little stupid slap cult meetings, you know. Everybody was chatting and grabbing their, I was no part of that, you know. And I wasn't hearing anything in meetings, just like Charlie Brown's teacher. Right? But in this treatment center, they introduced me to this theory that my body's physically different. And I could not dispute that. Regardless of what type my mind wanted to spin it, which direction, counterclockwise, it didn't matter. Any way my mind wanted to spin the facts are the facts. Right? And I had proof. When I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink. And being the mechanical genius that I am, you know, I equated it to that my body filters need to be changed and I can't go in and change them. You know, if I could go in and change my filters, just like you do a car filter or, another filter, I would do that and I'd be off and running, everything would be good. You know, because my filters are changed. I can't change my filters. So I'm screwed. You know, and then they started talking about this thing being hereditary. And my dad had died of alcoholism when I was supposed to go back and see him. He had died in his own vial. He couldn't roll over. In a blackout, puke, died. Right? My grandfather, I started thinking back on the history of this family of mine. And it just floored me. It just floored me at how rampant this thing was running through my family. And next picture came to mind is my mother and her finger. You're just like your father. And I went, holy shit. And I got this thing. I got it bad. And then I go to these meetings and everybody, see, I can't talk. I stutter. I mean, really, I can't carry on a conversation. Right? And all these tattooed, pierced up, hairy legged men just want me to call them every day. Right? I can't do that. You know, you tell me that the program's in the book, right? I can't read very well. My mind spins so fast I can't read. So you say, go to book studies. So I try to go to book studies. And then I have this trouble reading my pride, my ego, my stuttering, all this stuff. And I'm trying to count which paragraph is mine, you know, as it goes around the room. And the sucker next to me reads my paragraph. So early on, book studies are gone. Right, you tell me the program's in the book, I'm screwed, right? Because I don't understand what you're trying to tell me, and I can't go to these book studies, you know, because, well, pride, you know, and I'm screwed, you know? And so I was about 6 months sober. Anybody in the room here 6 months sober? Okay. I'm about 6 months sober, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, just going nuts. Right, I'm dying of the disease of untreated alcoholism. I got no spirit vodka or crystal meth in me to fix me. I have no spirit of a higher power. I got nothing to fix me. I'm stuck with an empty shell of a man who's restless, irritable, and discontent and not understanding what you're trying to tell me. All you're telling me is keep coming back. It works if you work it. Or we'll love you till you love yourself. Get away from me. Or this higher power crap. You know, I was in a Southern Baptist church. I was molested by this deacon sitting next to me. You know, so I just come in here. You're talking about God and men are hugging? You know, I'm out of here. Right? But I knew that I had this allergy. And I wanted the answer. And I don't know if anybody in the room can relate to this, but with me, when I'm afraid, when I'm really afraid, it comes out in anger. It sounds anger. It sounds like I'm pissed, you know. And that was pretty much it, you know. I was afraid that I wasn't going to understand and I wasn't going to survive. And I had made up my mind that I was only going to do this one time, right? And I wasn't going to listen to you because you wound up here too. So I'm kind of, you know, anyway, you wound up here too. And so I'm coming apart at the seams trying to solve this problem with the same mind that got me into it. Anybody try to do that? Right? You know, the book says if a mere code of morals or better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies didn't save us. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. And that was me. I can't think my way into... I can't. But I don't understand what you're telling me. And a guy from the podium, this little small little angry guy at 10 years sober. He wasn't angry, he was passionate. But anybody that's passionate, I kind of look at him like they're angry. You know, right? I'm very passionate. I'm not angry no more. Right? But this guy from the podium says, when the book says to pray, you pray. When it says to write, you write. When it says to talk to somebody else, do that. And so this light bulb went off in my head. You know? And this is the time after the treatment center, I'd gone into Pathfinders. And the cops were still out there looking for me. Right? And so I surrendered. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep running. I can't keep hurting the, you know, the people in my life. You know, I got to stop this. Got to stop the madness. And I went down to the Lemon Grove substation, sheriff station, and turned myself in. And I'm sitting there in my truck, and I'm all scared because I'm a runner. Right? Everything in me wants to run. You know, Mexico's 5 miles away. You know, I'm a runner. And so I go in there and I tell the lady behind the counter, you know, who I am and you're looking for me, you know? And she said, there's nobody here, you gotta come back later. Oh, crap. And, so I went back to my truck and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, see, I tried. I tried. You know? I tried. And I said, no, I can't do this anymore. And at that moment is when I honestly understood the first step. At that moment. It's not a question of if I'm going to drink. The question is when. Right? There's two questions in the first step. I know some of the pamphlets say 20. Right? There's even some pamphlets that say 44 now. Right? It just shows you the ego of alcoholics. We like to build on shit. Right? There's two questions in the book and only two questions. And they're on page 44 if you're interested. It says, when I start to drink, can I guarantee each time how much I'm going to drink? And I already discovered that my body does not process alcohol properly. So when I start drinking, I wind up in places I don't count on. And the second question is the kicker. The second question is the kicker. When I'm stone cold sober, why can't I stay that way? When my mind, when all these things that have happened to me should have been a sufficient reason for me not to drink, and my history proves that that one drink, it just keeps going, then why do I pick up that first drink? So I don't have a choice of whether I drink or not. Because I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory, the suffering, and humiliation of even a week or a month ago or 19 years ago. I am without defense against the first drink even today. You know, left up to my own devices. You know, and the second step is very easy. And I started reading the book as this guy told me to read it. When it said to pray, I prayed. Right? When it says to, you know, talk to somebody, I did that. You know, and so I started reading this book, and, you know, the second step is very clear, very important, and very simple, right? At the top of that page, it says, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself, what do they mean to you? At the start, this was all we needed to commit spiritual growth and to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. Then it says we needed to ask ourselves one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, there's a power greater than me? Well, if I'm powerless, I don't care what you call it. Right? I will call it, I wouldn't put a name to it. Right? If I'm powerless, there's got to be something. Right? And that's the second step. It's as simple as that. The entire purpose of this program is to enable me to find a power by which I can live. And it did. And my story is I had to take the 12 steps. I had to go through this process in order to have a personality change sufficient enough to even consider what a higher power was. Our literature is very clear where it says I don't need to believe in God to have a spiritual experience or to have a personality change. You know, our literature is very clear about that. I needed to have this personality change so I could believe in a power greater than myself. You know, so I could identify what that was. You know, and then I make a decision. You know, and a decision is just that. You know, I don't know if anybody is familiar with this, but on the, from page 52 to 83, is the kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And I know personally that there's not a telephone listed in there. And there's not a meeting listed in there. It's spiritual is inside. I suffer from an internal illness that needs an internal solution. But what my problem is that this thing won't shut the heck up long enough. Right? My biggest enemy is this. It's how I think. It's how I think that you're thinking about me, that I'm thinking about you. Anybody relate to that one? Right? You ever sit in a room and somebody's looking at you, go, yeah, I know what you're thinking. You know, and I suffer from this thing called self-centeredness, which is all in the mind. Right? You know, I'm in a meeting, and I've been sober a long time. You know, I go to certain places, and somebody passes me by, don't stop and shake my hand. Well, what the hell's wrong with that guy? Right? Am I even concerned about what they're going through? That just shows at times how self-centered I am. You know? I'm the most important person in the room. But I'm not supposed to be. See, that's what I have to treat. And in this third step, it talks specifically about that. Is that I'm like the actor trying to arrange the lights in the ballet. If you would just do as I wished, my life would be great. And if you won't, I may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest, and self-sacrificing. I'm a con. The pinnacle of a great con is having you do something and making you think it's your idea. And if that doesn't work, I get mad at you. Mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. Right? Anybody in the room like that? So, what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. And so I have to realize that that the third step decision is that I'm not God. And so I proceed with this, and I'll... Oh, what happens around here or around with me is that I need to get this to shut up long enough. And how I do that is not by calling somebody and talking about it, right? Because, you know, I have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I can't live up to them. I can't think my way into this thing. I have to act my way into this thing. So I pick up a pencil and a piece of paper, and whatever's whirling around up here, I pluck it out, write it down, and look at its value, find, and check its validity. And not my way. The way out of the book, because I try to solve the problem with the same mind that got me into it if I do it any other way. You know, and then I find out the value, and then I pluck something else out. And I write it down. Then I pluck something else out, and I write it down. And before long, this thing is shut the heck up long enough for this power that is within me to grow. And I get that sense of ease and comfort without drinking. Imagine that. And then the third step promises start to come true. When I sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. I have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provides what I need if I keep close to him and perform his work well. And I'm established on that footing. Almost 19 years of sobriety, I'm established on that footing. I become less and less interested in myself, my little plans and designs. More and more, I can see how I can contribute to life. I enjoy peace of mind. Anybody in here enjoying peace of mind? I got peace of mind. I discover I can face life successfully. Became conscious of his presence around 12 years sober. I had to sit in these chairs long enough for God to find me. But I kept going through the process. There's a part in our book that's misquoted so many times. Right? Grasping and developing a manner of living that demands rigorous honesty. The heck does grasping and developing mean? No way I'm going to be rigorously honest at 9 months sober, at 3 years sober. It's my self-righteous bullcrap if I am. Because I need to tell you exactly what I think or I'm going to drink. So grasping and developing this manner of living that demands rigorous honesty. And what happens is I discover I can face life successfully. I became conscious of his presence and I lose my fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I do not do this one day at a time. I have never done this one day at a time. If I came into this program and I had the mindset, again, this is my story, you know, if I came into this program and thought about it as a one day at a time thing, I would not have done the work that's required to stay. I would not have made my amends. I would have not gotten in my truck and driven to how many mobile stations and just walked in and handed the guy $20. I would have not done that had I believed that I just got today. I'll do it tomorrow. Right? That's my way, because I was not going to do this again. And I'll share with you a little bit about my life now. Is one of those daughters that I gave up for adoption, right? Because of my drinking. Right? When she was 13 years old and I was 3 years sober, I got a phone call from a father finder. This daughter wanted to know who her dad was. And I'm sober. Right? I'm supposed to be in jail, but because of this program and because of what I did, because of the miracle of AA, I'm not in prison. Right? So I have this daughter in my life today. I have two grandkids. And I'm starting to understand what it truly means for a family unit. You know, of not just a visual thing of how grandparents and daughters and son-in-laws and people are supposed to act. I'm starting to actually live it. You know, I went to the beach this morning with my friend. We took our dogs and my grandkids and my daughter went along. It was an amazing day. You know, that's not me, right? That's because of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because I've done this work, you know. And I'll say this in closing, is that I still require a spirit. I require a spirit in order to exist, right? It says in our literature that a spiritual experience It says, yes, replied the doctor, there's exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. And what I realized when I analyzed this book was that when I drank vodka and did crystal meth, I'm trying to change my ideas, I'm trying to change my attitude, I'm trying to change my emotions. I require a spirit, and if I don't find one, I will find one. I'll find a liquid, powder, whatever it is. Right? Because I can't live without this thing, without changing. And so the whole purpose of this program is to enable me to find this power by which I can live. And it says, lack of power is my dilemma. Drunk or sober, lack of power is my dilemma. And a dilemma means I got two choices, and they both are terrible. All right? And the book describes it as this. Either go on to the bitter end, blotting out of our consciousness as best we can, because I know how to live in jail. Right? I know how to function in jail. I know how to function in institutions. Right? To go on to the bitter end, blotting out of my consciousness the best I can, this miserable existence, or to accept spiritual help. And all of a sudden, when you say spiritual help, I think of those two men sitting next to me. I think of religion, and my mind slams shut. And if it hadn't been for that chapter, we agnostics, and some people who explained to me that this is not a religious organization, that you don't need to believe in this God. That's the whole purpose of this program, to find a power. If it weren't for those men who instructed me from Bill Wilson's program and not theirs, not their ego-driven program, but Bill Wilson's program, and allowed me to find my own path. And I'll say this in closing. In the inventory, it says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about stock in trade. Well, what is my stock in trade? Right? My stock in trade is any habit I will use to get my way. Right? I walk in a room and I size it up, you know, and I figure, what do I got to tell him to get my way? Right? That's my stock in trade. I'm thinking, how can I get over? Right? And so I start to think, do I need to be a submissive or do I need to be aggressive? Right? But I'm self-seeking and selfish and dishonest. That's what we have to treat here. And so this program enables me to live comfortably in my own skin. So if you're new in the program and all this sounds like Charlie Brown's teacher, right? Take a deep breath, pray, and read the foreword to the first edition that will explain everything. And it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show others precisely how we've recovered is the main purpose of this book. Right? So I'm a recovered alcoholic. It means I have hope. And I'm going to show people that I work with precisely. When I carry this message, it means I carry this message. I don't carry my message. If it's not in the book, I don't spout it. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm carrying a message. Right? I'm not a grandfather here. Right? I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who thumps the book. You guys have a good night. Thank you.